The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Guardian Radio AM. Today is Thursday, September 3rd. It's a little after 11 o'clock in the morning. Once again, this is C.A. Nuri and I shall be your host for the day. The numbers to call are 323-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259. And if you're calling from the Family of Islands, the number to call is 242-300-5720. And of course, I have the phone next to me, which is powered by BTC. The number that for that is 4224796, just in case you want to text me. Today, you have a distinguished guest in studio. So I slowed down. I humbled myself because you got to introduce her properly. We have former Senator Maxine Seymour in studio. I did a lot of massaging to get her in studio because she's always busy, right? But I want to talk about what is the Senate, because she's a former senator, right? Because I'm seeing some things, but I don't understand. I don't necessarily do not like, but I want to understand what a senator does. Then I want to talk some afternoon business. I mean, if I have an afternoon senator, I might as well ask some afternoon things while I'm here. Because they're talking about having convention early. I want to know if anyone pushed that to you. Like, did they ask you, hey, what do you think about having convention early? Does someone tap you on the shoulder and say, man, we need to have some bonding time? But I can talk about that later. First of all, you were tapped to be a senator. I want you to give a narrative of how did that happen, right? What year, whatever it is. And you are known to be outspoken, especially regarding children's issues and women's issues. You're an advocate. You're heralded as an advocate. You've been an advocate for years now. You've used your pen, your voice to promote equality, women's health, women's gender, children's health and gender. And I want to know why you use your platform for that also. So when in your introduction, mention all of that. And welcome again, former senator. Let me ask you this. I see a number of former senators continue to use the term senator. Is that appropriate?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. It's so good to be here. I am indeed honored to have been invited as a guest on your show. And you said a mouthful, and that's a good question because there are different practices between like the Westminster system, the U.S., other places. And so personally, I don't use the term senator.
So you're not Senator Maxine Seymour no more.
I am serving to create a better Bahamas. No title is required. So Maxine is my name, and that's fine with me. There are people who still refer to me as senator, and of course I answer, but that's another question. As far as the Senate goes, it's interesting that you ask that because I often think that the Senate has a whole lot of power, but doesn't necessarily use it. Because I'll tell you, the bill is passed in the lower house and sent to the upper house. And so if the Senate decided that, no, we need these things amended or corrected, or we don't agree with that, we're going to send it back down to the lower house, then that's something the Senate can do. The challenge is, that is that something the Senate will do when the majority of senators are usually appointed by the current administration?
What is the mandate of the Senate? Because I'm listening to you, and I'm now confused because I always thought the Senate was like the breeding ground, the training ground, it's a better word, for those who want to enter frontline politics, right? So they're in the Senate, they're just waiting time until they get the opportunity to get that nomination, right? And you see some senators doing some, what I call MP work. And I'm going to ask you about that too. But what is the mandate of a senator? What do you always do?
So the Bahamas has a bicameral parliament, right? And so there are two chambers. And so senators pass laws that govern the Bahamas.
That's what MPs do, no?
Of course, laws are passed in both chambers. And so they are passed in the lower chamber, but they're sent to the upper chamber where they're also passed before they're sent to the governor general. So the Senate could really be like a they could be the ones to catch something that's off, that's not quite right, that needs to be changed, that needs to be amended. As they debate, new ideas and issues might come up. And so they can send it back or suggest that there's a change or simply not pass the law. However, that's very unlikely because, like you said, senators are appointed in different ways. It's not a waiting ground. It's not necessarily a training ground either. It's up to the prime minister and the leader of the opposition how they select senators. There are various methods used. But indeed, many people came to politics by way of the Senate. For example, Minister Fred Mitchell, who I saw recently celebrated 34 years. Mm-hmm. He started out in the Senate. And so, yes, that's often where people start.
Once upon a time, I used to say, Harold, that in the Senate, you have better debate. In the lower house, they tend to beat on the table and act out and do antics all the time. But senators are sober individuals, matured individuals, who concentrate on what is before them, the law that's before them. It doesn't seem to be happening anymore. They start beating on the desk, start doing antics and throwing jeers also. The Senate now seems as if it's a second branch of the House of Assembly where everyone is jockeying for gotcha moments, right? And I'm not sure if you notice that, but I notice it because I just make fun of people, right? And I'm still trying to appreciate what is it or what's the distinction between a senator and a member of parliament because they are acting alike.
So you're right. Originally, the Senate, which is called the upper house, literally was where people aspired to be. And so being in the lower house years ago, historically, wasn't the place to be. Everyone aspired to be in the upper house. And the upper house did represent more mature, settled, just, I'm only talking traditionally, not that that is what it needed to be, but more mature, settled. And they approached the debate from a very intellectual, very meticulous way. And just like you said, they were they appeared to be more distinguished. In fact, when you are appointed to the Senate, you are automatically honorable. That doesn't happen in the lower house, although people have been loosely using the term and doing it. But in the lower house, if you're on the back bench or if you're a member of parliament, you're still Mr. or Miss. But if you're a senator, you're automatically honorable. And so you're right. The Senate was different, and the nature of the debate did take on a different tone. And now we have senators who are more passionate, who are more liberal, who some are younger, and so they do bring more creative energy to their debates.
That's how you describe it, creative? Yeah, beating on the desk is definitely junk new and creative. I appreciate that. What's the age to be a senator, or the minimum age?
I want to say that it might be 18. I did look that up at some point.
I think
point.
It's older because you're supposed to be matured. I think 21 maybe or even 30. Anyway,
I know that I it's know. Not. I did know at some point. I don't know it off the top of my head.
My texters and listeners will inbox me any minute now with that correct age. I see we celebrate the youngest ever senator the other day. And I'm saying I didn't know that was would be a big thing. I thought you try to get business professionals, learned individuals. So that, to me, that should have been someone who would be distinguished in age. But we now moving toward a younger disposition in and having the caucus of senators now. It just seems as that's the thing now. We want younger people there. And when I look at what the responsibility or the mandate or what the senator is supposed to be, it seems that it is a conflict. I'm not saying that the young people aren't talented. I'm not saying that they're not exposed. I'm not saying they lack experience. But for what we suggest the Senate supposed to be, I feel like we bastardize it. That's me pontificating now. You don't necessarily have to respond to that. I'm just saying.
No, I would only respond to caution you as Apostle Paul did, not to despise anyone's youth. But I do understand what you're saying, and that is that traditionally senators were older. They were more mature. But happy now that we see political parties embracing young persons, embracing women, embracing persons with disabilities. We need more of that. And so I think that your quantifiable age or your chronological age doesn't necessarily reflect the depth of experience or knowledge, not always. And so, for example, there are people who may be older who may not make ideal senators, who ought not to be leaders in our country, right? Mm. And there are people who are younger who who know how to conduct themselves, who are distinguished, who have worked hard, who are smart. And so I think it's more about the individual and what they bring to the table and not any other demographic type influences.
When you were a senator, mm-hmm. you got a small salary, a stipend, basically. We know that senators don't make any money. And I would lobby and say that you need an increase. I understand. But did you have a budget to do things? I'm asking that for a reason, because I'm now seeing senators outspending MPs who have a budget. And I'm saying, where they get that money from to be having every school start, the senator is having give back. Every Christmas, the senator is giving out ham and turkey. Every event or season, the senator can outspend a member of parliament who has a budget, $100,000 odd to spend. And they said, how can they afford that?
I do not know.
Where are they getting the money from then?
I cannot say. I can say, like you said.
The company
said,
giving them money for that?
When I was a senator, I only got $12,000 a year. And I did
and
not
for
get,
you?
And I did not get the full $1,000 a month. Because, of course, we had to take out certain deductions like pension and stuff. And so I cannot say where people get their finances from. Perhaps they have people who believe in them who help to fund their
and that's not
their
a concerning
service in office.
Issue?
For me, it is. I can't say that is for everyone. I mean, we have to be very cautious as leaders who we accept funds from, because we don't want to be beholden to anyone. And I think that often as a populace, we query certain decisions that are being made, but who knows? I mean, it may be some sort of reciprocation based on...
I am concerned.
Likewise.
Because the type of money I see in these senators spend, and I said, but they're not millionaires. They don't have no spare money, but the money they spend can compete with any MP who the government gave a budget to spend money with. And I said, nobody has asked, where does senator get that type of money from to keep on be given and given and given?
Well, most senators have work outside of the Senate. And so perhaps the senators you're referring to might have other employment.
Using your own money.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. I guess so. But let's continue on, right? There is a new wave of senators who like to, I wouldn't say blog, but they videotape everything they do. And I remember you yourself as a advocate, a women's advocate, as a child advocate, you use your platform to speak and engage to people. But these senators, we're talking about senators, seem to have a whole media team. Their media team follows them as they give out things, as they talk about topics. It's very promotional. They have an efficient and effective media team that follows these senators nowadays. And I'm saying, I'm watching you all, you know. It's not like you're trying to give, it's not like you're trying to, you're concentrating on laws. You're in it for self-promotion. And I want to know, is this part of the Senate mandate too?
We're in a digital age. Time has changed.
Ah.
In the past, perhaps senators just showed up to Senate and depended on newspaper reporters to cover them. But nowadays, some are embracing technology and they're exposing what they do, like you said, to others through social media. Kudos to them. I mean, here I am waiting for a selfie with you after the show. I wish I had a team to come in with me and set up the lights and the camera and, you know, so I can't knock them.
I have a producer now. He's taking pictures for me.
Oh, we got to ask him to take a picture then.
It comes with the job.
So see, I mean, listen, some people don't want to take that chance. So they just bring their people with them. And I've been places, I'll tell you, I've been places, small spaces where I was invited and somebody else was invited and people travel with 5-6 people. I'm telling you, 5-6 people, camera, lights, action, phones. I mean,
I see a lot of member of parliament doing that too.
If they have the means to do that, then, I mean, my way is the hard way. You know, a lot of people come to politics in certain ways and other people enter in other ways. For me, I've always had to work my way up every step of the ladder. And so I perhaps don't have the resources to do certain things, but people who do and they want to use them for self-promotion, then I guess everyone takes a different approach.
I'm starting to think politics in the Bahamas is for rich people, because only rich people can afford these things. But I'm just saying that. I got a text that says one must be 30 years old to be a senator.
I found it and I should have said it earlier.
Okay.
Correct.
This text says, Mr. Nuri, for God's sake, man, you mean the woman being in the Senate for 5 years and don't know the minimum age? See, they're critiquing you.
That's fine. Rightfully so. Actually, I did know it and I shouldn't have answered. But in the moment, I do know that it was young. That's fine.
And I understand.
I accept that.
It's automatically honorable because the design was for experienced people, likely older, to be in those positions. That's what the text says. For reviewing laws, you want that experience because it is more likely to detect issues with law that an inexperienced person, likely younger, may not. The change is why we pass so many laws today that are inherently flawed and nobody detects it. Senators just do whatever the party wants. No intellectual objections from the government side. Let me ask about that. You were a government senator or FNM senator. Let's correct that. Sorry, it was FNM opposition. You were an FNM senator. And people would say that your contribution was an FNM agenda. Do the Senate, those who like FNM PLP senators by design, is there like an FNM agenda or a PLP agenda for the senators? You know, like how they have the whip on and you say, well, this is what our plan is. This is our law and we got to promote it. There's no objection.
So like I said earlier, the challenge in the Senate is that the majority of senators are appointed by the current administration. And so there are 16 senators, 9 of them are from the government, 4 of them are from the opposition, 3 of them are appointed by the prime minister in consultation with the leader of the opposition. So we know what that means.
Yes.
And so then it's very likely that being appointed by a particular party, senators are going to express views that align with that party. And partly because when a law is drafted, people caucus in both houses before the debate starts in the lower house to discuss what the position is on that. And so, like I said earlier, the challenge I still don't think has to do with age necessarily, because even when there are times that you point things out in law or you see things that need to be corrected, it's very unlikely that the Senate will send it back down to the lower house, not in this particular climate. That's very unlikely. And for example, with the opposition, you can, like they say, the opposition will have its say, but the government will have its way.
Yes.
And so I've sat in Senate where the 4 of us have, you know, we've gone against a particular act or amendment or something. We've vehemently pointed out the challenges or concerns that there may have been. And like they said, you know, we tried because it's 4 of us.
During your tenure, has any of the bills been sent back to the lower house during your tenure?
Not at all. There was something I remember pointing out that that the leader of government business in the Senate at the time, Minister Akidas, he did say that he would take consideration of and point out to the government and, you know, look to consider an amendment because it was, I think it had to do with the Procurement Act, and they outlined certain categories of persons like women, certain business owns, and I said that we should have included like businesses owned by persons with disabilities, and he acknowledged it as an example of a good idea that he would carry back and consider like an amendment possibly in the future, but it still passed. And so, like I said, I mean, it's very unlikely that the Senate is going to send a bill back down.
In the past, when senators debate bills to be laws, right, the senator would do research on the topic and then go through the bill itself and see if it meets the criteria or any concerns and questions. I'm now seeing a number of senators in their speech, they go off topic, right, and talk about whatever concerns they have generally, not necessarily on the topic at hand or the bill at hand. They want to talk about a constituency as if they're the MP, rise to talk about this area. They want to talk about personal projects they are working on, right? Still not debating the bill that is in front of them. They're just using their time to, and I could buy words, self-promote whatever they want to promote. They say they have this platform, and they're going to use this platform to push these agendas. Is that appropriate?
So interestingly, members of the lower house and the upper house often appear to be off topic when rising the contribute on various bills. I can only tell you that for me personally, I always was about the bill itself and really speaking to it. And the record would reflect that. It's up to the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate, along with other members, to rise if they don't think that there's relevance to what somebody is contributing. But we should take seriously our job to review and pass laws for people. And that is why we should speak to them. We should, I know for me, I like to break it down because I'm concerned that in both houses, many people don't pay attention to the proceedings of the House. And so something happens, they start walking down the road in a purple shirt, the police stops them and say it's against the law. And everyone's like, well, I didn't know that was a law. When did that happen? Da, da, da. And it's because these people get up in Parliament often in both houses. They use these big distinguished words. Nobody really knows what they're talking about. And nobody really realizes some of the laws being passed. And that's why it's so important in both houses for people to really speak to the law at hand from whatever perspective, whatever worldview, from whatever, you know, aspect they may come. And so that is a concern.
Mr. Fred Mitchell, when he was a senator, said he was an independent senator and he expressed his personal views. We know that as a senator, you get nominated, put into position by your political party. I'm going to read this text.
I was going to say they are independent senators.
No. I understand. But he's still appointed. He's still appointed by whoever.
Correct.
By whoever appointed, right? So, yes, the opposition will always oppose. That's critiquing the opposition. And you can correct that or verify that. We're talking about government senators. If their objective is not to pass good law always, why are we wasting time and money? These laws are important for the country's good governance. Do they understand that weighty responsibility when they swear their oath? And I ask you that question, right? I understand an opposition senator, right? If the bill is a good bill or going to be a good law, do opposition senators oppose because they oppose for opposing sake, or they analyze everything and say these are the flaws and I put in the flaws to the issues to you?
Well, we absolutely don't oppose for opposing sake. I'll tell you, when the government does, and I used to tell my Senate colleagues on the other side that when you all do anything that makes sense, I'm gonna compliment you on it, okay? I may stand up that day and it might sound like I'm a government senator, because if it makes sense, I'm going to credit you for it. If it doesn't make sense, I'm going to call you out on it. So, for example, the new, and this isn't necessarily to do with laws being passed, but for example, the Minister of Education recently announced, I think, a technical diploma or something like that. And there was I came across a write-up on a news site on his intention. And I wrote a whole long comment about it. You'd think I was PLP. I am all for it. I'm like, finally, we have to understand students are different. They learn differently. They have diverse talents. We ought to recognize that. Everyone is an academic. I wish the minister well. And so, no, we absolutely don't oppose just to oppose. That's not healthy at all in a democracy.
Okay. I want to move from talking senator business now to talk some of your political business. I ain't go too detailed because sometimes I say y'all in turmoil and I ain't want to add to it because you know CNR is his like Beecher, right? You were a senator and you resigned. They had a very emotional speech. I remember, anyway, I know you, so I got emotional seeing you emotional, right? Are you still very active in the party?
I am definitely F&M.
You're still F&M?
F&M.
Okay, so I wanted to make that clear. In terms of party selection, right, how does the party select a standard bearer to represent the party?
To represent the party or to represent a particular constituency?
Constituency in for a general election, the process. Right. How does that go about? So I can understand it.
So the Free National Movement, obviously, is an organization, has a constitution, it has rules, it has things that govern it. And so there's a process involved in selecting a standard bearer for any particular constituency. And the final step of the process would be to be ratified by the council of the party. And so there's a process.
Okay. And you ran before.
I did.
Right? And there was a very electrifying time when you ran because people knew who you were. They knew your history and what you stood for. So I want to commend you for that. But how did you get the nomination, that process? Like you're interested in running, you're part of the party, you're part of the party's machinery, because you know you do promotions and advertisement, media type of stuff as a profession, and you were tapped. How did that tap come about?
So I was, and I had to fill out an application form, a very long, tedious application form with I think they didn't ask my blood type, but it was like a very extensive form and process. And then I had to go before a committee, and I remember it was the pandemic, actually, and so there was a long table in the room with a number of persons spaced, and I was, then there was a lone chair in front of the table, and I was grilled. And so, like I said, there was the form, there was the committee, there were the financial declarations, the meetings with attorneys, with, economic experts, and a whole process. Of course, I had to go before the council as well. And it wasn't just you can go and run. And so, like I said, there's a process without getting too granular, but it's very intensive. And I recall that it was quite intensive.
Did everyone in the party knew you were running? I want to know, how, if someone can come from the background and do these steps which you went through without anyone else in the party knowing that they're interested in running.
Well, if you're a Free National Movement member, there's a process. And so you can anyone can apply who qualifies to run. The point is, will you outpace all of those who also applied for that particular constituency?
Okay. And there was a critique in the FNM before, going broad now, where they said that a number of your candidates were lackluster. Right, I'm not critiquing the party because some of them I liked, right? But some general consensus, hey, why y'all choose that one? What do y'all look for? And when I say y'all, I'm not meaning you per se. But I mean, whatever the council was looking for, you hear the question, so you hear, okay, I see what they ask, so what they're based on. What do FNMs look for in a candidate to say, this is why you were selected? Do you need to have money? Because you're a working woman. You're a working woman, a mother, and I mean a very interactive mother. You go to all the PTAs. I see the pictures. You're intimately involved. And I got to ask you how a woman getting in politics soon, so that could be the next question, right? You're intimately involved with your family. And I had to say, boy, how Maxine could do all of this? I mean, you did it. But first of the question was, what they look for? And women in politics, especially women who are mothers in politics.
So as far as what they look for, like I said, there's a process. The candidate selection committee knows what they're looking for. For me personally, it comes down to, is every single candidate you select cabinet material? That's my thing, right? Because you have to remember, when you're going into an election, you're taking a chance. You can come out with 5 seats. You can come out with 20 seats. The leader can lose their seat. The deputy leader can lose their seat. And if indeed you win the majority of seats, and you're able to form the next government of the country, then whoever is the last person standing after the election, or after the polls are closed and the votes are counted, need to be people who can form the cabinet, make decisions, table laws, pass laws, make policies, create programs, manage the budget. And so for me, every single person who any political party selects as a candidate should be someone who can be prime minister, because out of all, we don't know what's going to happen. And so that person might end up having to lead if the deputy and the leader does not make it. And so that's the approach I think that is taken.
Now, women in politics, especially women like you who are actively involved, because I see you with your husband all the time. I see you intimate with your husband, love, like sincere love with him all the time. I see you with your children all the time. And I said, that can't go with politics, man. When politics, you need a monster woman. A mannish woman, and you're in that, you're demure, you're feminine. How can you survive in politics? How can women who are feminine survive in politics?
I think the whole conversation about women in politics is dated, first of all, right? And in many ways, intellectually and serious. And that's just my particular opinion, right? And so it's not a matter of whether or not women are capable or can survive. It's really about who is the best person, right? Because women literally have given birth to and led almost everyone everyone walking the face of this earth, right, was born by a woman. Women lead businesses. Women lead households. Women lead organizations. And so we know they're capable. And so in Barbados, for example, they're not asking whether or not a woman is capable. They're saying, you know, what is it we're looking for in a leader? What are the qualities? What is it in terms of accountability that we want from a leader? And so as we move into the future, which isn't on the horizon, it's here, right? We don't know what the next 5 years is going to bring to us as a country. We don't know what beyond that, the 5 years following that, what type of leadership we're going to need. We're coming out of a global pandemic. Right now, there are global economic challenges. We're still discussing the energy issue. There's technology that's driving the world and so many other things. And so the kind of leadership we need to move this country forward isn't necessarily the leadership we've had. And so I don't think it's about the gender at all. Like we talked earlier, maybe not even about the age. It's about the capability. It's about the mindset. It's about the individual. It's about, you know, whether or not they are able to help us as a country in the future. I'll tell you, are we satisfied and pleased with what the leadership is that we've gotten successively over the past decades? That's a question we should ask, because a woman has not been at the helm in this country. And so a woman cannot be responsible for the national deficit, for our debt, for anything in our country, any decision, major decision. We cannot blame the women for it. And our infrastructure is still not where it needs to be when it comes to our roads, our energy, you know, our grid, our power grid. There are so many questions, so many issues that are outstanding in our country that need to be properly addressed. And I don't think, like I said, it has anything to do with gender. We really have to look at who is the best person to lead.
Would you offer yourself again?
Right now, I'm enjoying my role as a citizen of the Bahamas. I care about the things that everyone else cares about. I care about, you know, energy. When the power goes off, that impacts me. The prices at the grocery store, at the pump, they impact me. And so for me personally, I'm enjoying my time as a citizen and leading through communication, which is what I've always done. And communication is an important part of leadership.
We're going to take a quick commercial break. We're talking to former Senator Miss Maxine Seymour. When she comes back, I'm going to talk about leadership race. They're saying that they definitely need to go in the caucus and have convention. I want to know what you think. We're going to leave that for the next side of the break. Just want to let you know that this show is sponsored by Island Game, islandgame.com. And we're going to be right back.
Just sign in and have a seat, please. They'll call you in for your x-ray shortly.
That's why they call it a waiting room. You won't have that problem at Fourth Terrace Diagnostic Center or Imaging at Rona. We never schedule multiple appointments, so you'll be in and out in no time. And if your initial screening reveals a concern, our radiologist can conduct an alternative screening right then and there. Call 328-8157 to schedule an appointment at Fourth Terrace Diagnostic Center or Imaging at Grosvenor today.
Girl, Junior just showed me Bulla Boy in his phone.
What you mean? He take picture of that good-for-nothing boy?
Shh, you don't want Bulla hair. You say that. You know she always say that's my good child.
So what he doing in Junior phone?
Oh, he there because the police looking for him. He on that wanted list.
Wanted persons in your phone now?
Yes, child. And when police want to find anybody quick, after something happened, they can send picture direct to your phone. Go to Google Play or App Store and search for Crack Crime Bahamas, then pick install and it will go straight to your phone.
There is also a section on missing persons.
Yes, girl. Everybody needs to get this app so police can tell us right away when these people go missing. Just like an alert system.
Yes, it has numbers for Crime Stoppers Bahamas so you can call and nobody knows you. Call directly to Miami and give the information without giving your name or anything about you. I tried the other day and when I hear Junior and his boys talking about where they hide those guns, I walk quick around the corner and call that number.
Call 328-8477 from Nassau or 242-300-8477 from the Family Islands.
Are you ready? The Chickchawny Challenge returns Saturday, September 26th to Clifton Heritage Park for Bush Party 2026. Take on an action-packed obstacle course to one of Nassau's most rugged and beautiful landscapes. Run solo or bring your crew. Gun time is 6:30 a.m. Register now at chickchawnychallenge.com. The Chickchawny Challenge is proudly sponsored by Advantage Insurance, RF Bank and Trust, Kalina, Guardian Radio 96.9, Party Pilots Rentals and Events, and Click. Bush Party 2026. Get dirty, get challenged, get there.
Attention Island Game players. Percy's pension plan is now accepting applications. Deposit $25 and you are officially in the running for a weekly salary of up to $1,000 a week for a full year. Applications close September 8th. Apply now at theislandgame.com.
For fast, reliable, and impactful printing services, look no further. Let Printmasters bring your masterpiece to life. We stand by our quality products that is second to none. Our affordable pricing and friendly, efficient staff makes Printmasters the ultimate choice for all your printing needs. We can deliver any type of printing services, from banners to booklets to business cards. You name it, we can print it.
Let Printmasters bring your masterpiece to life.
Located at the Nassau Guardian Building, telephone 302-2361.
We're going to give you a check every week for a year.
Percy's Pension Plan, Island Game, keep you winning. Percy's Pension Plan, dream big, we will help you live it. Percy's Pension Plan, Island Game, we got you. Percy's Pension Plan, from the friends you can trust. If winning is a must, come play the game you know, cause your best chance is with us. The most trustworthy name is Percy's Island Game. So put 20 on your account and ride this easy train at Percy's Island Game.
And welcome back to Guardian Reader AM. We have somebody who's on the line waiting for a while. Let me get this person to engage, Ms. Maxine Seymour. Go ahead, caller. You're live. Caller, you're live.
Hello.
Hello, go ahead.
Yeah, I didn't even realize I was on the phone. I hope you didn't hear my conversation. But I it was an interesting conversation. This lady, she sounds so much like Robin Lyons. I just have a nice radio voice. I just wanted to ask her a question that I see. Let me turn on the radio a little bit. I just wanted to ask her, you know, as a 62-year-old man and noticing the development of Nassau and most political, the ruling class, they're not interesting. Everybody's talking about sustainable development. We're looking at Nassau as a confined space. I do a juxtaposition in my dog ears. You don't need to design the whole certain amount of people. Why is it that nobody's talking about overdevelopment in Nassau, the deforestation that's taking place, juxtaposing that with the PM's narrative on global warming, et cetera, et cetera? And the decentralization, you know, given the potential of Freeport, Andres, Abaco, et cetera, and all the other islands, it's frightening for me that when I ride around and traverse around the 7x21, there's always a gated community, a hated community here and there, and nobody seems to be addressing the problem of Nassau being overcrowded. You know, we have tourists, et cetera, and we have a compilation of inefficiencies as relates to services. But nobody's thinking about this futuristically or panoramically. And I can't see it just keep going the way it's going, even as relates to even businesses. Everything is fused in Nassau. This can't be the way to go. I mean, decentralization, even as relates to the ecosystem, you could juxtapose it with the electrical grid. You can see there's shortcomings, but nobody seems clairvoyant enough to see the problems that this will bring in the future. It just everybody comes to New Providence, I should say, this park, and nobody seems to want to decentralize and look at the effect on the ecosystem of this island. You know, we look at golf courses, et cetera, here and there. No ordinances. Like we're talking developing world and first world, but our minds are still imbecilic as it relates to these things. The PM talks about climate change and global warming, but yet still we see where just everywhere everybody wants to throw up a plaza or a gated community. They're just eating up all the bush out east and out west, and I wouldn't say the rest, more or less. Give thanks.
So I'll tell you, that caller is a very, very wise man, and I'm happy he raised the issue. I'm equally concerned about the things that he would have outlined. From an environmental perspective, we have to manage some of the development and overdevelopment that's taking place on New Providence Island. From just a human perspective, I cannot even take my child to the beach because as a populace, we all have to share one or two public beaches on an island because like he said, everything, every time there's a new development going up, there are fences going up, there's a wall going up. And in fact, I spoke the other day to the issue of parking on Goodman's Bay because we allowed major developments that didn't even consider parking for their employees and sufficient parking. And so now they've taken up all the parking in the middle. You drive out west, instead of enjoying the nice trees in the median, there are cars in the median, there are cars on Goodman's Bay. And so you can't even enjoy the beach. We already have a flooding issue on this island, okay? We already have a public transportation issue. Our power grid already is being stretched. And so he's right. We need to focus on how do we get some of that interest in the Bahamas and development, really, how do we get it rerouted to other islands? And he's right. We need to look at this long term. We need to stop looking at just the moment, just the day, and start to govern for the future. We have to look at the future. The Bahamas in 5 years, in 10 years, in 20 years. Are we preparing our students today to meet the needs of the country tomorrow? Are we protecting our environment? Because we're talking about global warming out of one mouth, but then are we when we approve projects? Okay. Are we considering, we talk about global warming, so we knew everyone was going to be hot and turn air conditioning on in the summer. Did we make sure that we were prepared for it from a power standpoint? And so he raises a great concern as a citizen and someone we all need to pay more attention to it, because at the end of the day, the capital is going to be impacted by every decision we make.
So there's talk about a convention for your party. There's a lot of talk about your party in general and media. And I know you're an active member, right? And some of these talk is above your I wouldn't say a pay grade, but above how your activity is, right? From your point of view, is there a need to go on convention now?
This is an absolutely great time for our party. It's a time that we could really self-reflect, okay? It's almost like a reset. And that's how life can be. For example, if somebody works to a company and all of a sudden the company downsizes and or restructures and they end up getting a package and they end up having to figure out what next, it's a great time because you could self-reflect, you could see where we're at, you could see where we need to go, you can reflect on the past, you can consider the future, and that's where we're at as a party right now. And so the question is, like I said earlier, based on where we're going as a country, what type of leadership is required? What do we need to carry us forward? The world is changing. Our country is changing. And so we need to ask ourselves these questions and we need to answer these questions. And whenever we do go to convention, there's a process, like I said, that governs us. And we will all, in fact, I'll tell you, people talk about leader, but there are chairman, there's a chairman, there are vice chairman, there are deputy chairman, there are right down to, council reps, chaplains. And so as an organization, there are so many leadership opportunities. And whenever we do go to convention, of course, they will all be open and up for grabs.
What type of leader does the FNM need? It's two different questions now. What type of leader does the Bahamas need?
I think those are one and the same, because like I said to you earlier, when you choose candidates, you want to make sure that they could all run a country, right? And so the kind of leader the Bahamas needs really is the kind of leader the FNM should want to have. And for me and for leadership, it's a question of vision, because you need to be able to you need to tell us where it is that you see us going and how we're going to get there. And so I think for leadership, vision is important. I think the ability to listen is important, because no leader has all the answers. And leadership is something that's done, in tandem with a team. And so being able to listen, that's important. Having compassion and empathy for the people you lead, that's important as well, because I'll tell you, leaders live nicely. The boardroom table, the cabinet office, the chairs are nice, the desks are nice, the refreshments are nice. And so if you don't have a heart for people and you get in those meetings and you can't recall the mother on the bus stop waiting for a jitney that's not on schedule, or, the challenges with public transportation, if you can't recall the flooding in your constituency and stuff because you really, in that moment, you're not considering the people, you didn't bring the people in the room with you, then that's a challenge. And so leaders who have vision, leaders who have empathy for others, leaders who listen, because it's always important to listen even more than you speak. And one of my favorite quotes is that leaders who do not listen are soon surrounded by people who do not speak. And so leaders have to be very careful when people go quiet or silent or are withdrawn, because the question is, why aren't they saying anything? It's very likely they have something to say, but you're just not hearing it. So a leader who can listen, that's important. And a leader who understands what sovereignty is. And for me, sovereignty is more than a flag and a national anthem. If we're a sovereign nation, when we get to tables, we need to act as such. And so independence, that was a particular step. But sovereignty is a journey. And so a leader who understands and prioritizes sovereignty, preparation, future, who prepares, because disaster preparedness, for example, we can't wait, God forbid, for something to happen for us to prepare for it. And so a leader who is futuristic. And I guess those other minor soft skills like charisma and everything else that people talk about, that's one thing. Maybe someone can learn it, but at your very core, you have to have a certain level of competence and capability.
A leader who has RAS. See, I have the modern talks now. We have a caller who wants to engage you. Let's get this caller to speak to you. Go ahead, caller. Guardian Radio AM, you're live.
Good morning, Mr. Nuri. Hello, Mr. Nuri.
Hey, go ahead.
How you doing? One time we had a leader for 25 years. I know you remember one of the biggest speeches was, we got into the first world. 53 years later, we're still in the third world and we ain't see the second world yet. But all we do is manufacture a good bunch of speakers who could speak good and talk and talk and talk and tell us they're going down Bay Street to represent us. And every 5 years when they go down Bay Street, we vote them to represent us. They hold the Holy Bible and say they represent the king and the governor general and the prime minister. They don't represent us till next 5 years when they come up. And before I go, power's off for the second day, 95 degrees in Florida State, right over the hill behind Tommy Turnquist there. For the second morning, I just park up my dogs and my van with my air condition. They're about short fun going for a ride. Power off again in Florida State. And you know I used some 10-pound words when I was talking about that. Have a good day. Power off again in Florida State. Now!
This text says, good morning, CA. That lady, Maxine Seymour, is a very intelligent woman, and we need persons like her to govern our country. Okay, let's read this way. It says, Sir Lyndon would be rolling in his grave if he knew what this government is doing to this country and how bad he is treating us Bahamians, especially essential workers. CAN guests, where is environmental health? Who is protecting our beaches and land? Because everything being overdeveloped, overpopulated, and nothing is being upgraded. The monstrosity they put on the beach has destroyed the water. Have you seen how muddy and nasty it is and smells like sewage out there?
It's so sad.
Let's go to this next caller. Go ahead, caller. We're talking to Maxine Seymour, a former senator for the FNM. Go ahead, caller. You're live.
Good afternoon. I love a lot of things that you're saying, ma'am. Interesting. You bring in a lot of things to light. Some of my concerns, though, with the FNM, I want to ask this question. When the party comes together, when the decision is made, when you're moving into election, and there are statements that are being made, and the way forward as to how you're going to run, how that you're going to lead in terms of if you won, you know, you won the election, does that come from just the leader, or is that a combined group of persons coming together to say this is what the agenda is going to look like?
So that's a very good question that she asked, because leaders are different, and that's what we talked about earlier. There are some leaders who are collaborative, who will ask everyone around the table, listen, who do you think is going to be best? Where would Nuri be best? What about so-and-so? He was a former architect. So-and-so, you know, they're an attorney. You know, and so there is that collaborative style. And then again, leaders do have the ability to make decisions autonomously. And so you may have leaders who say, no, this is where I'm going to put Nuri. This is where I'm going to put Seymour. And so like she asks, it really depends on the leader. It depends on so many things, because at the end of the day, the prime minister of the country chooses their cabinet. And I'm sure there are considerations, I'm sure there are conversations, I'm sure there's collaboration, but the decision ultimately lies with the prime minister. But that is a very good question, because I always say in politics, are we looking at people's experience? Are we looking at their qualification? Are we saying that, okay, when I build this team, like I said, when you choose candidates, everyone should be able to serve in cabinet. So do I have someone here who understands environmental health? Do I have someone here who knows all about public works and who can handle it? Because having that competence, that capacity matters. In the late 90s, I worked at Ministry of Health and Public Relations. And sometimes I'll travel the island on these little tiny planes with then Minister of Health, Dr. Ronald Knowles. And I'll tell you, he'll walk into a clinic on a family island and he'll ask, why is the refrigerator on X temperature? And a doctor would start to talk and, oh, well, Minister, you know. And he'd be like, no. Yes, the MMR or the MRI, whatever vaccine is in there, but you also have this particular vaccine and the temperature should always be at XYZ. And I used to follow him. I never used to say anything. My job was to take photos and to write up articles and stuff. But I'd watch Dr. Knowles. Nobody could swing him. What does that mean? That means that when you appoint a minister of health, you need to have a competent physician who understands not just medicine, but administration, people, management. He was a workaholic. We would land on that island 6-7 in the morning. By 4 or 5 o'clock, we whispered among ourselves, somebody wants to like be the one to have the courage to bring to the minister's attention. We haven't eaten all day, but he was about to work. So I say that to say that leaders need to decide among all of the people who they have around them who fits best where, not just who I like, not just who might have supported me, et cetera, but who is best for the country in certain spaces. That's important. And she asked a very, very relevant question.
Ms. Seymour, I want to ask you back. We're coming to the end of our show, but I want to talk some more African business. I'm sure you can get some phone calls today and say, how dare you? But we appreciate it. It's a breath of fresh air to hear how frank you are talking about Effingham issues, where you see the party, where you see the leadership. And we want to learn about the mechanisms on how this party machine works. And perhaps we could understand why things are happening like how it is. So I plan to invite you back. We'll talk more about senatorship, because we have a lot of rock star senators nowadays. Everybody taking camera and spending money where I can't find where they're getting the money from. And I want to talk about some more Effingham business on why things happening like how it is and what's the way forward. We have just been talking to former Senator Miss Maxine Seymour. I truly appreciate you taking time out to
Thank
come
you
and
for
sit
having
down
me.
And speak with us. We can talk a women's agenda and women's and children's rights next time we come. This has been Guardian Radio AM with C.A. Nuri. You have a wonderful day.
Guardian Radio 96.9 FM, streaming on guardiantalkradio.com and the Guardian Radio app, Nassau, Bahamas.